Do you think that a lot of Christians make a mistake in trying to have a power struggle? We want to take back the culture that we used to have, rather than persuading people once again of the Christian gospel, which will ultimately transform their lives.
Well, I mean, to me, the biggest thing that will change people's lives is the example other people give. I mean, I think religion is an experience. You don't believe because, you know, you've convinced me in an intellectual argument.
Five centuries ago, in taverns and public houses across Europe, the masses would gather for discussion and debate over the latest ideas sweeping the land. From one such meeting place, a small Cambridge inn called the White Horse, the Reformation came to the English-speaking world. Carrying on the tradition, welcome to the White Horse Inn.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the White Horse Inn. We've dedicated 2006 to what we're calling the Romans Revolution. Since, by my reckoning, that's about 50 or so broadcasts, and this is a radio program rather than a church or Bible study, we're not going to go verse by verse exactly. We're instead going to use Paul's famous letter as the map for all of our programs this year, covering the major arguments and themes of Romans with application to contemporary challenges and opportunities. In this program, I want us to focus on the relevance of Paul's letter for our day. Many people have called Romans the Bible's catechism, or a miniature systematic theology of the Bible. That's because Paul covers the most important Christian teachings in a very brief space. It's not surprising that the context in which this epistle has sparked Reformation has always been a profound ignorance of the basics within the church. Whenever we don't actively focus on the gospel, we passively drift back into self-obsession and self-righteousness. That's where Jesus found Israel, where Paul found the Judaizers in Galatia, where Augustine found Pelagius and his followers, where Luther and Calvin found the medieval church, and where much of the church seems to be today across the denominational spectrum. I won't go into all the surveys. We've done all of that on other programs, but suffice it to say, it's startling to see the stats on how impoverished are the majority even of regular churchgoers in America, even in evangelical churches, when it comes to even the big issues of Christian faith and practice. In many ways, the Reformation was simply an attempt to re-evangelize and re-catechize the Western Church. No less is needed today, and Romans, as they realized, is the best place to start. We have our usual cast of characters, minus one. Dr. Kim Riddlebarger is pastor of Christ Reformed Church in Anaheim, California. The Reverend Ken Jones is pastor of Greater Union Baptist Church in Compton, California. I'm Mike Horton. I teach at Westminster Seminary, California. And sitting in for Dr. Rod Rosenblatt is Dr. Jean Edward Veith. Dr. Veith is a professor at Concordia University, the culture editor for World Magazine. It's great to have you on the program, Dr. Veith.
Yes, good to join you.
Witness to a post-Christian culture is what we're talking about in this program. Turn on Christian radio or visit a Christian bookstore / paraphernalia shop, and you'll see two really big obsessions. First, the obsession with me and my personal happiness, how to fix your life and get what you want in three easy steps, of course, with Jesus' help. Shallow narcissism, greed, kind of shamelessly embracing as values what the Bible calls vices. And then at the same time, there's this obsession with crusades for saving America and restoring our moral sanity. Is this sort of a conflict? Is the church part of the problem it's trying to solve?
Well, I think it really is. Just the lack of knowledge. I notice that non-Christians today don't even know what Christianity is. That it has something to do with Christ, God become flesh. It has something to do with forgiveness. It has something to do with the grace of God. They've never heard that. They think Christianity is about politics and moralism, and they've never even made the connection about who Christ is and what he's done for us. But the problem is, the church is the same way. When you talk to Christians, they too leave Christ out of it. They too often leave grace and forgiveness. For many of them, it is about moralism and politics and living the same kind of worldly life that everyone else does.
Hmm. So there's a disconnect here between looking at our culture today and saying, boy, we've got to fix this. We've got to get the right people in office, and we've got to clean up the culture, while the churches themselves don't seem to have the light on.
Yeah, they seem to follow the same pattern of the world in terms of moral and political crusades and causes, looking at man strictly from a therapeutic vantage point, and what's wrong can be fixed with therapy and different recipes. And certainly it's been indicated by a number of polls that the morality of Christians oftentimes reflect the reality of non-Christians as it relates to sexual ethics, as it relates to marriage, and a number of other things.
Yeah, we're talking about symptoms. In the book of Romans, Paul's going to talk about the problem.
That goes a lot deeper.
It goes a lot deeper than just the kinds of surface things that many Christians are concerned with.
We talk about ours being a post-Christian culture, but has there ever really been a Christian culture? And how does the church usually do in those environments?
From a redemptive historical perspective, the only Christian culture was Israel, a theocratic state constituted by God for the purpose of giving us his word and the Messiah. But there have been cultures that have had great Christian influence upon them. But we don't see a distinct theocracy on earth post-Christ that fits in redemptive history as a divine vehicle for the giving of revelation, the transformation of culture, and so on. The kingdom of God extends into all the world. You know, the Abrahamic promise, universalized by Paul in Romans 4:13.
So Christianity isn't a culture.
It's not a culture.
Yeah, and many American Christians would be surprised to hear that. In fact, I've gotten in trouble on a number of occasions for making the statement that America is not and never was a Christian nation. You know, and as you mentioned, Kim, there are nations that have been strongly influenced by Christianity and by the church.
And that's a wonderful thing.
And it's a good thing, and we should acknowledge that, and it obviously has been for the good of those particular nations, but that doesn't make it a Christian nation in the strict sense of the term.
Yeah, most religions are cultural. If you become a Muslim, you adopt the Islamic culture. If you become a Hindu, if you become a Buddhist, anthropologists talk about religion as being ways of kind of sanctioning the culture, making the culture holy so that people will become a part of it. And that's part of the tendency, Paul would call it part of our idolatrous approach to religion, to turn it into a cultural religion, to just make it say that we're okay and our way of life is fine and that makes it sacred. But Christianity, of course, is so different from that. Christianity is for every tribe and every language under heaven. It's for every culture. So it's not a culture, so it works in every culture. And so, but I think we're always going to have to fight that tendency to make it into a cultural religion. And that's a big part of the problems of American Christianity. Their version of Christianity is a cultural religion. And they're making it a pop cultural religion. For those people whose only culture is pop culture, then they're sanctioning that with religious kind of ideas.
And you're a culture editor for a magazine, so you're not saying this because you don't have any concern about culture, but you're making clear distinctions.
Well, right. And culture is a gift of God. Romans 13, as we'll get into this year, talks about how God himself works through human vocations. He works through cultural authorities, through governments. Not a particular kind of government. He works through all kinds of government and through human institutions and through cultural institutions to keep sinful people from tearing each other apart. And so I would say God does work through culture. And it's not that it's a Christian culture, but we can value culture as something that God works through, and so we can honor it. We don't always have to be cutting ourselves off from it or rejecting everything from human culture. Romans 13 doesn't let us do that. But at the same time, the church is different from the culture. We're citizens of both realms, but at the same time, there's distinctions we have to keep making.
Let's talk about some of the parallels between Paul's culture, his context, and our own. Jews who didn't understand their own scriptures, Gentiles who only weeks before were involved in pagan rituals and orgies. What are some of the big parallels between Paul's day and ours?
Well, first of all, you've got the whole question of the relationship of church to state. Christians were facing the problem of the fact that Judaism had been considered a legitimate religion by the Roman Empire. And now as Christians find themselves pushed out of the synagogues, as Christians and Jews begin to start to debate, who is this Jesus? And Christians find themselves pushed farther and farther away from the synagogue. Now all of a sudden they're facing the question of, all right, how do we as Christians relate to civil government? Which is why Paul addresses that in Romans chapter 13. There's the question within the church, given in, especially in the early chapters, the focus on Jews as blind guides and so on, and then the focus on Gentiles in Romans 1 and the downward spiral of sin that they'd fallen into. So there's the whole question of how do Jew and Gentile relate to one another in the church. And then Romans 9 to 11, there's that grand discussion of the relationship of Jew and Gentile in God's history. There's the discussion of the weaker brother in the latter chapters of Romans. All the ethical questions come up, but most importantly, Paul deals with the question of sin and grace. What happened in the fall of Adam? How bad was it? What did it do? And what did God in Christ do to resolve that? So it's the gospel's the primary theme that jumps up from the pages of Romans, but the gospel has to be addressed because of the situation in that particular church.
Yeah, the gospel is the announcement of good news, but the context of that good news is the condition of fallen humanity.
Yep.
And Paul summarizes that condition as being one where we have revelation of varying sorts, both natural and special, but in our fallen state, we seek to suppress the truth that God has made known by our unrighteousness.
Yeah. I think, Mike, to answer your question directly, the question of how are we right with God is addressed by the book of Romans. The question is, now that I'm right with God, what am I supposed to do? How do I live my life? That's addressed in the book of Romans. My relationship to the state, to culture is addressed in the book of Romans. My relationship to other Christians, how do we get along with people with whom we have different cultural backgrounds? All of those things are addressed directly by Paul in this wonderful, wonderful epistle.
Let's listen to a clip from an interview, on-the-street interview, where we asked a couple of questions that sort of get this ball rolling.
We're wondering what modern Christians think about whether or not we're living in a post-Christian culture.
We live in a predominantly secular culture. Well, yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean, you know, in the Middle Ages, Christianity was the culture, completely dominated the culture. In our culture, you know, Christianity is probably becoming, you know, more like a minority.
Do you think that a lot of Christians make a mistake in trying to have a power struggle? We want to take back the culture that we used to have, rather than persuading people once again of the Christian gospel, which will ultimately transform their lives.
Well, I mean, to me, the biggest thing that will change people's lives is the example other people give. I mean, I think religion is an experience. You don't believe because, you know, you've convinced me in an intellectual argument that God is real. I think the biggest thing that religion has going for us is that experience, that feeling you get when you come into a community, and that's what religion is all about.
Did Paul say that in this context, which is so much like our own, idolatry, sexual immorality, a culture falling apart, collapsing in on itself, did Paul say, really, the best thing that you guys can do there in Rome is to just set a good example?
You need a Christian Caesar and a Christian Senate. That'd fix everything.
Yeah. One of the things that sort of came out in that interview about religious experience, there is a tendency for fallen humanity to look within for their own moral solutions or the solutions to their own moral condition. He touches on this in I think it's in chapter 10 when he talks about don't let anyone say they're going to go into the heavens and bring Christ down or into the earth and bring him up, pointing to the fact that our salvation is found in what God has proclaimed in his word. So he says, you know, it's as near as your mouth. It's near as the word. This is where your salvation rests. Because again, the tendency is for us to look within or to erect, systems outside of us or systems of, on our own to help us in our spiritual and moral conditions. And so Paul is very clear from the very beginning, number one, that all have sinned. and are all are therefore under the just condemnation of a holy God, and the only solution is that which God himself provides, which is what the gospel is.
And it's fascinating that Paul keeps pushing the reader, the hearer, back again and again to what God has done. History is thoroughly anchored, Christianity is thoroughly anchored in history, and that's what makes Christianity unique as opposed to the Greco-Roman mystery religions.
Mm-hmm.
And to Judaism's tie to history, but history going nowhere.
One of the things that I heard in the clip, too, is something that you hear again and again and again. Yeah, certainly. Look at the dominance that the church had in the Middle Ages, for instance. Basically, the idea is those were the good old days, and now look at us now. But what was the state of the church when it had all this cultural power?
Well, just read the lives of the popes and the record of the troubles with the church over property issues and nepotism and all the rest
that
went on.
Good thing we don't have that
problem. Yeah, we don't have any of those problems today. I mean, the medieval church, as was the ancient church, is characterized by a collected body of sinners who behaved accordingly.
And yet, what's amazing is the churches Paul shepherded in this robust, deep root, you know, planting new churches like the church in Rome, planting them deep in these doctrines, in these precious truths.
And in the midst of paganism.
Yeah. In the midst of a rabid paganism, actually was like wildfire. These churches grew under persecution, not just because of persecution, but because they had been armed with something that was able to fire that wouldn't go out because of persecution, but would only get hotter.
And that was the ongoing challenge, even in the book of Hebrews. How does one hold to the content of the gospel in light of external persecution? But to go back to something you had addressed earlier, the church in the Middle Ages, it's very easy for us to romanticize. As you mentioned, Mike, say, well, those were the good old days. If you look at the church during the Middle Ages, this is why Erasmus was a reformer.
Mm-hmm.
Because there were problems within the medieval church. And he was a reformer in attempting to clean up the moral excesses of the church, whereas Luther saw that the problems were not just moral excesses, but it was a deviation from the gospel itself. So you really see the church at a difficult point, even during the period of the Reformation or just prior to the Reformation. And the same thing in American history. People go back to a certain golden era in American history and say, well, when prayer was in the schools and when we had this, that, and the other, that's when Christianity was on top of things in our culture. And we forget the bigger picture of American history during that same period.
Mm-hmm. Times of cultural hostility tend to be the best times for the church.
Absolutely.
When the church is at its purest, when it's thriving, and it's in times when the culture seems so friendly and accommodating, and the church and the culture grow together, that tend to be the time of real corruption and loss in the church.
Let's go to one more clip here that frames our discussion a little bit.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So when you say post, you mean, yes, I do believe that, absolutely. And why do I believe that? The laws that are going through Congress, you know, wanting to take God out of certain, you know, maybe the Pledge of Allegiance, or you can see it in hospitals. You go to hospitals, there's like a denial of God everywhere in some respects. So generally, yes, I do believe it. Yeah.
What do you think is the best response to that from a Christian perspective? Should we seek to legislate our rights, or should we once again try and proclaim the gospel and win the hearts and minds of those who are not convinced of Christian truth?
That's a good point. I really believe it's our personal witness to everyone around us. And the more we're proclaiming Christ in our lives, I think people are going to see that.
Do you think that one of the problems we face as American Christians is that it's a consumer culture, that we can pretty much get what we want? We go to the food court and we have any choice we want, and we view religion that way? So it's a god of our making?
I think so. Could be, yeah. Because if you don't like one church, you can go to another, and you can keep moving around. There's no accountability in some respects on that.
By the way, these are, when I said on the street interviews, they're actually in Christian environments, Christian colleges, churches, and so forth throughout this whole program. The early Christians were ridiculed and even considered seditious because they opted out of the religious cults that were bound up with patriotism and, you know, being a full member of the community, even though they were like everybody else in terms of what they wore and, you know, their use of everyday speech and so forth. They fulfilled their vocations. They weren't called by the apostles to act strangely. And yet they were very strange to the Romans, in part because they would gather together to worship this dead rabbi the Romans had just crucified a couple decades ago. And then they eat his flesh and drink his blood. They're cannibals. These kinds of accusations flew in concerning the early Christians. Today, doesn't it seem that a lot of kids growing up, even in evangelical churches, would never even know why Christians were ridiculed like that in that pagan culture? J. Gresham Machen said something years ago. He says, we're going to come to the day when preaching and sacrament and Wednesday night Bible studies or prayer meetings will be sort of like the Turkish whirling dances.
Whirling dervishes.
Whirling dervishes to people in our culture. And aren't we approaching that now, even with kids growing up in evangelical churches who really don't even have the sort of ordinary forms of Christianity, not just the spirit, but the forms of Christianity that we used to have?
If you've grown up one of these large mega churches, then you've been in a place where Christian distinctives and sacraments and things that have been pushed aside anyway. My fear is the only place people come in contact with these classic Christian categories anymore when they're lampooned by the secular culture. Look at South Park or The Family Guy or some of these other things where you watch for 5 minutes and watch the pagans laughing at this, much like the Romans laughed at the early Christians. And our kids don't even know what the pagans are laughing at.
Yeah.
Well, it's, you know, in our community, there are a number of churches that no longer have Wednesday night prayer service. They have what they call Wednesday night praise, or that's the time for praise dances and things that are me-centered rather than regular old Bible study and prayer meeting.
Well, this past Christmas, it was reported in all of the newspapers and on television that the world was shocked that churches, mega churches across the country were closing their doors on Christmas and New Year's, because Christmas and New Year's happened to fall on Sunday this year, because they thought everybody should be home with their families or off doing whatever they wanted to, probably at the mall shopping. You talk about consumerism, and they wanted to give their employees, as they called their staff, the day off.
Well, face it, Mike, it's a lot of work to take down on your Christmas Eve pageant stuff and all the lighting and scaffolding, and you need a day to do that anyway.
Well, I mean, isn't it really remarkable that we're going after the culture and just acerbic about how post-Christian it is, and our churches are post-Christian?
Well, and we hold on to empty phrases like being a witness for Jesus. How can we be a witness if we don't even know what the message is?
Well, we're witnessing both interviews, the people mentioned that their life was their greatest witness.
Yeah.
Well, I don't want my life to be my greatest witness. I would hope my life would be transformed. My greatest witness should be my proclamation of the gospel of Christ to people, not look at me and how I'm living.
Yeah. But if your gospel is Jesus came to show us how to live and give us good advice and good experiences, then that's pretty much what we're called to do.
Well, I guess I have a twofold response to that. On the one hand, it shows the self-deception of this generation that we think we are good enough to be modeled. And then on the other hand, it's interesting to me that, again, people say that this is our biggest responsibility is to be a witness. But if what you mean by witness is live a morally good life, as defined by the culture and usually not by the righteousness that God has revealed in his holy word. But if that's the case, the question then is, do we really need Christianity to do that? Haven't the Mormons modeled that sort of good behavior?
Sure.
Ed, do you think that Paul would say, hey, the response to the culture is try to show the life of Christ in your own life? That's the good news?
Not at all. It's interesting that the word for witness in Paul's time in the ancient world was martyr.
Yep, yep, absolutely.
But even the martyrs were not saying, here, be like me, get burnt up and lion in the Colosseum. They were proclaiming the word of God, that is, proclaiming Christ, and not as a matter of what we must do, but how he gives the forgiveness for the things, for the ways we've fallen short. Of course, another issue and a big similarity between the ancient world of Paul's time and our own time, just increasing, is religious relativism.
Yeah.
In ancient Rome, it was a very tolerant society. Many religions, all the different kinds of paganism were all accepted, and people could believe in whichever one they wanted, and people had their individual deities that they had a special relationship with, and that was all fine. But the Christians wouldn't play that game. They were proclaiming one Savior for the world, for every culture, for everyone. And I remember coming across a statement from one of the Romans in some of the anti-Christian writing of the time, and he said, you know, these Christians, you know, they think they have the only truth. And they're saying some of the same things, some of the same charges against Christians today. But one of the things we see in Paul is the universality of sin, whether you're a Jew or a Gentile or whatever you are. This we do have in common. We're sinful and unclean. And also then the universality of Christ's work, and which is for Jew and Gentile, and it doesn't matter what group you're in. And so the Christians were different, not just culturally, because they wouldn't go along with a culture, but they wouldn't go along with the relativistic mindset. Another thing that was happening in paganism at the time was it became pleasure-centered. It became a way to get God, to get your God to do something so that you'll be wealthy or happy or prosperous or whatever. And I'm seeing kind of a new kind of paganism, a new kind of polytheism, really, mm-hmm. in people who are willing to accept all the different gods of the different religions. And mm-hmm. it's all right, whatever is right for you. But of course, that's just a way of locking themselves up in their own little world, making an idolatrous religion in their terms that really shuts them away from the truth.
Would Christians have gone to their deaths over, hey, Jesus works for me, and you can add him to your pantheon of ways people can experience God?
Hard to believe that they would have.
Wouldn't quite have gotten them killed. By the way, that's Gene Edward Veith. For those of you who just tuned in, I call him Ed because we're friends, and this is sort of a long story. Friends call him Ed, so if you're wondering, I'm happy to be in that class of people who name Ed a friend. Gene Edward Veith, author of numerous books, Postmodern Times, a whole host of other books. God at Work is one of his latest. Anything, by the way, Ed, coming out in the next weeks or months?
Well, I have a brand new one out called The Soul of the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, about C.S. Lewis tying into that cultural phenomenon, the book, but in the movie, a bit really trying to unpack that gospel-centered message that's in that wonderful fantasy book.
That's great. Guys, let's go to one more clip here and see what else we have to ponder.
Well, it seems to be heading that direction. If it's not here already, it probably will be soon, unless somebody does something. You know, I think the whole war on Christmas was kind of representative of the popular direction, at least it's being pushed through the media. So if you want to rebuild a culture, you start with yourself, you move to your family, you move to your community. So certainly being, you know, a witness and raising up godly kids, being a witness in your local community has the power to change hearts more than trying to affect the laws.
Yeah.
At the same time, we have a responsibility, I believe, to be active in the political forum, to take leadership roles when possible, and to help steer communities, societies, governments in a Christian direction. But in terms of being on a stand like a Pat Robertson type of thing where you're really, you know, thumping the Bible, that doesn't seem to have a real positive effect on persuading people. It's more like preaching to the choir, and if the choir is shrinking, then that's probably not the way to increase its number.
You know, when Rome finally did collapse, even after it had supposedly been Christianized, the church father Jerome said, "What will become of the church now that Rome has fallen?" And then Augustine, his contemporary, said, "Hey, what are you talking about? God has brought the mission field to the missionaries.
Yep.
Doesn't that kind of change things instead of trying to defend our right to this culture and we should have God in the public school? Instead of that, what if we said, hey, this is a great time. In Eisenhower's day, everybody thought they were Christian and they're actually unevangelized, but they think they're Christians. Maybe this is a better soil in which the gospel can take root.
Well, remember, if Paul is anything, he's a church planter and a missionary. Hmm. And every letter he writes, he's thinking about the expansion of the church and the spread of the gospel. And would that we had the soul and spirit of Paul again.
Yeah, and I appreciate the fact that what you mentioned about removing prayer from the public schools or whether or not God's name should be mentioned in the Pledge of Allegiance. And Ed, you could probably, I guess I can still call you Ed. We're still friends, right?
Oh, yeah.
But I think this drives home the fact that most Christians are not clear or even aware of the distinction of the two kingdoms, how we can actually serve this kingdom or this culture without confusion and serve God and still have separate spheres, that there is a sphere of influence or authority in the church that is particular to the church, and then there is a place for the church to interact with the larger culture in all aspects, whether it's music, politics, or whatever, without compromise.
What if the church celebrated Christmas instead of closing?
Yeah, that would help.
That would be a novel idea, would it not?
And actually focused on Jesus.
And the incarnation.
And the incarnation and the nativity.
And how about if Christians catechize their children at home and really don't care if their teacher leads them in prayer or not?
Amen. Charles Hodge, the Presbyterian theologian at Princeton, wrote a number of years ago, when Paul and the other apostles were called to enter upon their important duties, the world was in a deplorable and yet most interesting state. Both heathenism and early Judaism were in the last stages of decay. The polytheism of the Greeks and Romans had been carried to such an extent as to shock the common sense of mankind and to lead the more intelligent among them to openly reject and ridicule it. This skepticism had already extended itself to the mass of the people and became almost universal. As the transition from infidelity to superstition is certain, boy, that sounds like our day, from atheism to Madonna, and generally immediate, all classes of the people were disposed to confide in dreams, enchantments, and other miserable substitutes. The two reigning systems of philosophy, the Stoic and the Platonic, were alike insufficient to satisfy the agitated minds of men. The former sternly repressed the best natural feelings, inculcating nothing but blind resignation to the unalterable course of things, and promising nothing beyond an unconscious existence hereafter. The latter regarded all religions as but different forms of expressing the same general truths. Among the Jews, he goes on to say, among the Jews generally, the state of things was hardly much better. They had indeed the form of true religion, but were in a great measure destitute. The Pharisees were contented with the form. The Sadducees were skeptics. The Essenes were enthusiasts and mystics. Hence, when the glorious gospel was revealed, thousands of hearts in all parts of the world were prepared by the grace of God to exclaim, "This is all our desire and all our salvation." Sounds like our context, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So why would Paul answer those problems with what a lot of people today would call the Bible's systematic theology? Shouldn't he instead have said, you know, you've said the prayer and you've asked Jesus into your heart, you Roman Christians. That's great. We've got the gospel down. Now the big thing really is to live for Jesus and take back Rome.
Well, a couple of things I think have to be said. One is that you know, Paul is someone who has a systematic theology. He sees Christ on the road to Damascus. His entire worldview is just rocked by that experience. He goes into Arabia and Damascus, learns from the apostles, talks to Peter and all the rest of them, gets his theology together. But his letters to the various churches throughout the New Testament are occasional letters. So the letters are written to particular congregations to address particular situations. So I'm a little nervous about speaking about Romans as a systematic theology. It's a letter to a church that it flows out of Paul's overall systematic theology. And the issues going on in Rome are you've got an oppressive government with the beginning of the deification of Caesar, with Caligula and AD 40, and then the Edict of Claudius kicking all the Jews out. So everything's in turmoil. That fits exactly what Hodge was talking about, that the Romans starting to come apart at the seams, which explains why Nero would rise to power shortly thereafter. You know, the deification of the emperor is a real issue. And in the midst of that, you know, Paul's instructing Christians, no, you have to regard legitimate civil government as a minister of God.
While they were dipping Christians in wax up to their necks and lighting them on fire.
So you've got those questions going on. But the issue seems to be, look, the reason why society tends to pull apart is because we are sinful. It happened to Israel. Look at redemptive history. Paul will make a theoretical point about a doctrine and then go back again and again and illustrate how that was the case in the Old Testament. He shows that Israel didn't come to fruition because of Israel's rejection of Christ as Messiah. That's why Israel's falling apart. As for the Gentiles in Romans 1:18 and following, they're in this downward spiral where God's giving them over to their sin because they've rejected not only natural revelation, but special revelation. So their society is engaged in all kinds of horrible things, and they're in this cycle where they're falling apart. So Paul addresses not the symptoms, but the real root of the problem, which is human sin.
Hmm. Paul Achtemeyer, in his commentary on Romans, I don't recommend all parts of the commentary, but there's some real gems there. Here at the beginning, Achtemeyer says, its impact, the book of Romans, its impact on the church at critical times in the church's life shows its significance plainly enough. When the Roman Empire was tottering and the foundations of a civilization were crumbling, Augustine learned from Romans how one can see God's larger purposes beyond the breakdown of a civilization. When the church exalted itself too highly in its own understanding of the ways of God with humankind, Luther and Calvin learned from Romans how a church could be structured which allowed the gracious lordship of God in Jesus Christ to come to clearer expression. One touches the roots of one's Christian faith when one deals with Paul, and nowhere more so than in Romans. To confront Romans is to confront one's faith at its source, to have it judged and healed, to have it called into question and renewed, to have it shattered and restored in stronger and more vital form. Isn't that exactly what we need today as we face the crumbling culture?
That's exactly right.
Let's take one more example of an on-the-street interview at a Christian church.
Do you think the American church is somewhat influenced by this post-Christian culture? It's a consumer culture, and it's about making me happy and being entertained, et cetera, et cetera. And have our churches turned into places of entertainment and fun rather than serious devotion, serious worship, serious theology?
Bingo.
Why do you have some questions?
I was just
going to
say amen. Absolutely. The church, again, because, you know, we are under assault, we made the decision to somehow get along and get these people to like us somehow. The problem is, too, is that many of our churches today are aping the culture. You can't really see much of a difference. The churches that take the stand on the gospel, you know, are the ones that, you know, there seem to be few and far between, but we're not seeing it in these so-called secret-sensitive churches. You know, it's a great place to come and fellowship and drink coffee, but, you know, there's no...
the music, but there's
no rallying cry that... you know, that Christ is still on the throne, that we have work to do.
Well, and it's also, unfortunately, if you look at the typical young Christian who grows up in a Christian home, but is still under a huge influence of culture, wherever they go, they are bombarded with entertainment. So even education in the public forum has become pretty much entertainment. And so when they go to church and they start to take over the roles of music director or youth pastor or whatever, as young adults, they're going to de facto bring that cultural orientation with them because it's natural, it's normal to them. That's part of what I would call the degradation or the breaking down of liturgy and worship in the churches. Mm-hmm. So when you go into church and you hear a rock band playing a praise song just like any other rock band at any other rock concert, it is very difficult, I think, for many people to get into a reverent, worshipful state.
Wow. One of the things that I'm constantly amazed at is in doing interviews with secular media, how often the conversations go off the record for a long time with the reporter, and you find out what they really think of the people they're interviewing. A lot of times it's on, for instance, the latest megachurch movement or this trend in the church or that trend, and a lot of times the entertainment and the church is just capitulating to the culture. And these secular reporters get it. Mm. They say things like, I might consider going back to a church that actually taught something or that actually took things seriously, but I can stay home and find my entertainment my own way. Isn't it staggering that a culture that's crumbling from within because it is, as Neil Postman said, amusing itself to death, is the very culture we're emulating instead of taking a book like Romans and preaching through it and catechizing our children in it and forming our worship services around the great truths here and really taking it in deeply, inwardly digesting it until it transforms us?
Was Ken Meyer's great line, the church is in the world but not of the world, or of the world but not of the world but not in the world, yeah. By adopting that just a wholesale embrace of pop culture.
Well, Neil Postman also said in that book, Amusing Ourselves to Death, when he talked about what's lost when church goes to television, that there's a loss of transcendence. And the amazing thing is what we've seen is even in the actual auditorium where worship is supposed to be taking place, there is a loss of that transcendence. Okay. You don't need television to lose the transcendence. Of worship now.
And when the minister is, you know, tiny up front because the church is so big, and now he's plastered her up on the wall in the big plasma screen, you've turned the live worship service into a televised event.
Yeah.
The Colosseums were filled regularly with the great comedians, the great orators. I mean, a lot of the church fathers.
Lion feeding.
Instead of being eaten, we're being eaten alive by a culture of entertainment in different ways today. But that's exactly the culture. Maybe some of the church fathers went too far by saying, okay, you can't go to the theater.
Yeah. Tertullian, yeah.
But you can understand what they were saying. You're becoming so saturated with the passing fancies of this culture that if you had a thought, it would die of loneliness. And isn't that exactly where we are in the church today? Matt in Palm Bay, Florida. Good evening. How about that? Are you there, Matt?
Yeah, now I am.
Okay, sorry about that.
Anyway, guys, I've been listening to the show for over a year now, and you guys have really been a blessing to me. Just for fun, I visited my old church, and this is the way it was. Repeat after me. I am a child of God. I am me, I, me, I. And then it says, everybody give a hand clap, and then after that, they said, okay, now let's all praise Jesus. And it gets real quiet. They're not saying anything.
Yeah.
And it was amazing. I'd never noticed that before until I got to that point.
Yeah, you step foot in a historic Protestant church or a Lutheran church and things are sure different.
Oh, they sure are different. And the other part, and since we're talking about the post-Christian culture, they actually kind of want to walk back into Christianity through that kind of thing, that kind of confession where they confess a lot about themselves. You know, like I used to confess about myself a lot and not really confess much about God. So they don't really have any practice in even witnessing to a world that needs to hear the gospel.
Yeah, it's really remarkable, isn't it, that we learn very little, actually, about Paul in Romans. We don't learn very much about Paul anywhere else except in Acts where he's being talked about and a little bit in Galatians, but we don't learn very much about Peter. We don't.
Yeah.
We actually don't learn very much about Jesus, like what his favorite color was, or if he were a tree, what would he be? You know, the witness.
What his hobbies were.
What his hobbies were. Really, it's all about who Christ is and what he's done. That's the testimony. That's the witness that the apostles believed would change the world.
And it did.
I've learned more about witnessing from attending church and just participating in the liturgy and the word and sacrament than I did in 25 years of being in Baptist and Pentecostal churches.
The Baptist at the
bad Baptist church.
Not that I know that there's one person sitting there at the table that might take offense to that, but I think he knows what I'm talking about.
Oh, no, I grew up in bad Baptist church, so I understand that. You know, in fact, I got in trouble for this at a Ligonier conference a few years ago. I made mention of the fact that if anyone else asked me, what's your story? And, you know, I think I'll puke. people, that's why our people are dying in our pews, because they know too much about our story.
They want to hear about the story.
Exactly.
Or even if they don't, they should.
They know all the details of the pastor's life, our children's lives, and all of these nice little interesting details, but know absolutely nothing about Christ.
Thanks a lot for that call, Matt. You know, going back to Hodge's description of the culture of Paul's day, just look at some of the examples he gives. First of all, Stoic philosophy, basically saying it's all fate, you know.
Get it out.
Don't have any emotion. Then the Platonic philosophy, basically reducing all religions to saying the same thing in different ways. That's pretty much what we hear from a lot of Christians today, that Christianity is sort of one way you get in touch with God. Or the Pharisees, on the Jewish side of the ledger, he says the Pharisees contented with the form, the Sadducees were skeptics, the Essenes were enthusiasts and mystics.
Fundamentalists, emergent, and Pentecostal.
Our day has a lot in common. When we hear from people, for instance, who say, it's just my experience that counts, you know, don't want to know all this stuff that Paul's going to be unfolding and unpacking here. That's deep water. Just give me an experience of Jesus in my heart. That's what a lot of folks are saying today, isn't it? And yet, when Paul lays this gospel out in clear, simple terms that anybody can understand, the church grows.
Well, and we're moved emotionally.
And we're moved emotionally.
We're moved emotionally. The very thought of how wicked I am and how great God's grace is and how undeserving I am of it all stirs emotions and it creates a powerful experience. But it's an experience that grows out of what I know that God has done for me.
It certainly wasn't a post-Christian world. It was a pre-Christian world that Paul was addressing there in Romans. And yet, the great irony, through the preaching of that message there in Romans, much of the empire, at least nominally, came to believe in Christ. You wonder why the church that becomes powerful and popular always turns back to itself and back to moralism and away from that gospel when it becomes successful.
Well, it's that whole business again of God's story versus our story. The story of Romans takes us from the Garden of Eden all the way to the resurrection at the last day. It's redemptive history. It focuses on what God is doing in Christ to save sinners from the guilt and power of sin. Moralism, the whole notion of Christianity becoming a system of ethics, turns it all back on me and my life and my problem, how I fix this and how I go about doing that. And that is the fundamental point. Is our religion going to be God-centered or man-centered? It's as simple as that. I think Van Til called that absolutely correct. We spoke of autonomy being the self-centeredness of this all.
Yeah, and the ultimate issue for modern believers or evangelicals is not how one becomes justified or right before God, but how one can patch up this little leak in my life so that I can be more fulfilled and whatever else I want to be.
And then is it any wonder that we just reflect paganism around us?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Gene Edward Veith has been sitting in for Rod Rosenblatt tonight. Ed, thanks so much for being with us on this broadcast.
Oh, great to be with you.
And we'll look forward to continuing our Romans Revolution. See you next time on the White Horse Inn.
The White Horse Inn is a listener-supported broadcast. To find out how to support our efforts, give us a call at 1-800-890-7556. That's 1-800-890-7556. You can also check out the support tab of our website at whitehorsein.org. That's whitehorsein.org.